week on race and class. This was a section that I kind of skipped over. And then in retrospect, I think it's just something that's worth keeping in mind when you think about the connection between race and class and how it figures in sociological explanations and historical explanations for various sorts. This will apply equally well to many contexts of ethnicity and ethnic-like divisions within classes. And it has to do with the centrality of the family as a locus of building particular kinds of social relationships and how race and ethnicity intersect family. And this is also a place where race and gender come into play. So it's, I think, an important way of thinking about it. We normally think of families primarily in terms of their roles in biological reproduction, you know, producing and raising children. But families are also absolutely foundational in creating certain kinds of social networks of responsibility and trust and reciprocity that has a long time horizon. And this is really a key idea to think about. This will come up in our discussions of class formation as well. The question of the time horizons under which people act and the time horizons under which they think about their likely future interactions with people is really important for the formation of solidarity. Solidarity is about certain kinds of reciprocity and trust. That's what the stuff of solidarity is. We will discuss this later. And this is one of the things that families accomplish, sometimes well, sometimes badly. They accomplish long time horizons. People who are parts of family and kinship networks know each other by name, and they know that they will know each other in the future. They have a long time horizon of reciprocity. And the long time horizon of reciprocity means that, first of all, you know who in your family is trustworthy and who isn't. So it's not that in families there aren't black sheep, as it were, people who aren't trusted. But you know that if you help someone out now, it's not that that particular person will help you out when you're in trouble later, but someone else in your family will. It's what's called generalized reciprocity rather than bilateral reciprocity. And kinship networks are weaker versions of the same thing. Your cousins can call on you in an emergency in a way that very few friends can. Now, sometimes friends become very family-like, and that's how it's experienced. The family is the model for the kind of loyalty and long-time horizon reciprocity that can be generalized outside of the family. Okay, so that's a particular thing about family. It's why families, with respect to the concept of community that Albert and Hannah were talking, families are also a kind of special community. They're where identities and cooperation and long-term reciprocities are forged. All right, so what does this have to do with race and ethnicity? Where racial divisions and ethnic divisions are strong, very few families and kinship structures span those divides. So the possibility of building reciprocities across racial divisions rooted in the family are very weak, where racial divisions are strong. Now, I mean, I don't think this is an obscure point. Imagine if blonde hair and brown hair was a racially salient division. They are, after all, phenotypic characteristics. You can identify a person as, well, of course you can dye your hair, but that's brown-eyed and blue-eyed. Let's take that as, although with contact lenses nowadays you can pass, but you get the point. When racial divisions, therefore, are salient, families aren't formed across those divides. It's one of the reasons why miscegenation is such a powerful part of racism. Prohibitions against marrying across racial divides are absolutely central to how race works as a social category. That's also true for, in certain contexts, for marrying across religious divides and ethnic divides. But not always. Now, an extremely interesting case that I don't think has been adequately studied centers around the Balkan Wars of the 1990s. In the frontier areas of Croatia and Serbia, that is the parts of both what were previously provinces and became countries, in the areas around the frontier, there was extremely high rates of intermarriage between Croatians and Serbians. Croatians and Serbians are ethnically identical except for two things. One are Eastern Orthodox and one are Roman Catholic. Croatians are Catholic, Serbians are Eastern Orthodox. And their alphabet. The languages are identical. They're as close to each other as American and English and British English are. They have exactly the same cuisines, the same folk dances. I mean, there's the only divide is religion and alphabet. In the frontier areas in eastern Croatia, roughly 40% of households involve marriages of Serbs and Croats. So in the prior period, in those areas, it had ceased to be a salient division. You know, kids went to high school, fell in love, had sex, and got married, just like anywhere else. And since religion wasn't very important to people, they were very kind of European in that sense, and had religion was just one of the things you did on ritual occasions. It was basically a non-issue. So then the question is, what happens when the Balkan Wars begin, when the Serb-Croat war begins? What happens in those towns and villages which had such high concentrations of intermarriage? And how do they cope with the challenge of ethnic cleansing? In a context where ethnic cleansing would mean breaking up families. I mean, you know, the families couldn't simply be moved one place or another. There's a little bit of work on this. Maybe there's more than I'm aware of. It has not become a central focus of research around the question of ethnic identity and how it works. It's my understanding that what happened was initially there were local militias formed that were mixed of Serbs and Croats, but that basically provocateurs from the warring sides outside of those immediate regions who wanted to intensify the antagonism between the groups because they had political goals of becoming a national elites within the context of the disintegration of the old Yugoslavia. They engaged in acts of random violence against the opposing group and made it extremely costly for people to remain indifferent to the ethnic divide by raising the risks of being attacked by one or another. So since it was more dangerous for a Croat to consort with a Serb than to retreat into the enclave mentality of a defensive Croat solidarity, those militias disintegrated. They could not reproduce themselves under the pressure of what were essentially the acts of terrorist provocateurs. That is, active Serbian nationalists or Croatian nationalists that wanted to make it impossible for there to be a Serb-Croat militia combined. I think it's an instructive case. It shows that where there were family ties strongly across these lines, it did facilitate the formation of an anti-ethnic coalition, but it wasn't robust in the face of such severe ethnic challenges. Yeah, Dan.
Well, does what you read say anything about how that affected the families?
I don't know. I mean, I would love to know that story. It's an incredibly interesting case. And it's an unusual case. It doesn't usually happen that you had such a long period of complete ethnic tranquility. where people really forgot, you know, and it really, it wasn't, the image that you sometimes heard from that period is that during the Yugoslav period, 50 years, because it was an authoritarian state, there was a lid kept on a boiling cauldron, and the lid came off. You know, there's this idea that all these ethnic tensions were there boiling beneath the surface, and as soon as the authoritarian regime disintegrated, then everything exploded. From what people have told me when I've lectured and traveled there, that simply is not the way it was. I spent a week in Sarajevo. So this is a digression, but it's such a great story. So I was invited by a group of undergraduate students at the University of Sarajevo to give a keynote address at a conference they organized on Hegel, Marx, and Freud. You know, and I said, I don't know anything about the bookends of that trilogy, but I can give a talk on real utopias. So I went and gave a talk on real utopias. But I spent a week with these undergraduates in philosophy, sociology, and political science. This was a group of students in their 20s. They were a little older than typical undergraduates because of the disruptions of the Civil War that they had lived through. This was 5 years ago, so it was after, it was 8 or 9 years after the peace had been, the wars had stopped. They all had traumatic experiences. They had lived in Sarajevo during the siege, and it was, you know, it was horrible, the things they had told me. They were at this conference, this conference was organized by students at the University of Sarajevo who were Bosnian, Serbian, and Croatian, but all from Sarajevo. They were desperate to be cosmopolitan Europeans. They were sick and tired of the whole ethnic thing and thought this was ridiculous. I mean, they had absolutely no desire to participate in those processes of ethnic identity formation. But I had just been through this unbelievably traumatic experience. So at the end of the week with these wonderful young people, it's one of the most interesting visits I've done of this sort. We were having a kind of party, drinking and talking, and in a spirit of kind of tremendous goodwill and fellow feeling, you know, I had said to them that I was very curious about these issues of identity, because as far as I could see, I shared a much closer common identity with these students than I did with my fundamentalist Christian neighbor across the street, who, as far as I can tell, comes from a different planet. You know, I can't understand anything about anything, much of the way he thinks.